Our speaker this morning is Tracy Love Silver. Tracy is a member of our congregation. For more than 25 years, Tracy has been an advocate for women, children, and at-risk populations in Memphis, Tennessee. As a nonprofit management and resource development professional, she served in positions that included volunteer, board member, executive director, consultant, and founder of organizations that range from the seventh largest in the nation to grassroots social service startups. Beginning in 2006, she turned that knowledge around and became a philanthropic advisor, helping people to give in a more focused and efficient way. She has also spoken nationally to groups including state attorneys, financial planners, and fundraising professionals. And she has been at UU for 20 years. Please welcome Tracy Love Silver.
First of all, I'd like to say that this is the first time I've spoken without a PowerPoint presentation in a very long time. So anyway, I've spoken a lot over the years about philanthropy. I've helped people and families to develop charitable giving plans that reflect their values and to do that more efficiently and thoughtfully. I've helped financial planners and estate planners help their clients give to strengthen their own personal and family legacies. And I've helped nonprofit organizations to build deeper relationships with their major donors. But as a progressive, as a Unitarian Universalist, I don't think there is any more important concept in charitable giving than how we can increase the impact of our giving, especially in the current political climate where the need is so great and the resources are so stressed. It is more important than ever to really focus our giving and to do everything in our power to make the most impact with that giving. Now, there are basically three ways that you can increase the impact of your giving. You can give smarter, you can give to smarter people who can make their money go further, and you can use your giving to really send a life message, to communicate the legacy that you want to leave to the people that are closest to you and most important to you. Everybody knows that there are a lot of ways to give smarter. Knowing the best asset to give and when to give can save a lot of money over time because of tax implications and that kind of thing. That's why major giving needs to be done as part of an overall financial or estate plan. That's a really interesting and really important topic, but that's not what I'm going to focus on. The second way to increase your impact is to select smart recipients. To select the organizations that are going to use your money most efficiently. But there are 1.3 million nonprofits in the United States, and all of them will tell you that they're doing good work. And that is just not true. Also, it's interesting to know that the number one reason why people give to one organization instead of another one is it literally that one asks and one doesn't. That is not the best plan of attack either. Not all charitable organizations are using your donations effectively and efficiently, so choosing wisely between them can certainly make a difference in the impact of your money. But that's not what I'm going to talk about either. Although I have done entire workshops on that, that's not what we're going to talk about. There is no doubt that we need to give smarter and get the dollars into the smartest hands to do the best work with them if we're going to make a meaningful impact on the causes that are so important to us. But it's that third way to increase our impact with charitable giving that I think is critical and most important to us as UUs to focus. That's where we really need to put a new focus. There is no doubt when we think of traditional philanthropic impact, we naturally think of the benefits to the cause or to the nonprofit, and that's obviously really important. But today I'm going to be very selfish about giving. I'm going to talk about what's in it for us, what's in it for our families, what's in it for our community, for our individual and collective legacies. That's why the Bridge Builder poem. When we think of charitable giving, we have to think past just handing money to the right people, but it's the legacy that we can build to really advance our values that matters. What message can we send with our giving when we put our money where our mouths are? What valuable life message can we send to the next generation? How can we use our giving to get something valuable for our family, for our church community, for us? Well, as a philanthropic advisor, I've seen the growing mountain of research that clearly shows that philanthropy has a unique and proven ability to build family unity, to clarify shared values, to educate younger generations on responsible spending, and even prevent and heal rifts in the family. In fact, super wealthy people have been using philanthropy for decades as a teaching tool to make stronger families. And there is a growing industry out there that helps them do it. And most of that industry is in estate planning and financial planning. These advisors are painfully aware that 70% of inherited wealth is lost by the second generation, and over 90% is lost by the third. Family philanthropy has a proven and unique ability to prepare heirs to handle their inheritance and to transfer the wisdom and values of the wealth earner. In short, these advisors are helping with family philanthropy as a strategy to keep money in families, the money that pays them to manage it. And incidentally, the philanthropy-focused advisor community, which I have been connected to throughout the years, is overwhelmingly filled with Mormons and fundamentalist Christians. In fact, we have here in Portland, we have a large organization that is their focus. And they teach advisors all over the country to do it. So there are a few organizations, however, that were largely started by progressive members of affluent families. And they exist to help families of means preserve the values of the wealth earner, to keep affluent children from falling into the Paris Hilton trap. Inspired Legacies, this one, and 2164, those are both websites that are worth going to if you want to really drill down on your giving. And they were both founded by progressive second-generation inheritors with the goal of helping heirs use their privilege in productive and meaningful ways. And they're great sites. But even these organizations are not geared for normal people. They're there to help families with private foundations and literally millions to invest in philanthropy. Simply put, they are the only ones who can pay advisors to help with their giving. And advisors, with rare exception, have to make money. They have to support themselves. So for us regular people, we've got a couple books and a website or two, but for the most part, we have to figure it out on our own. Although few of us will ever have the luxury of actually using the services of these specialty advisors, I learned a lot when I worked with them, as I was helping them help their clients employ philanthropy as a family unity strategy. So the first of these examples is a really, really, really wealthy guy who we call Bob. Bob was divorced and he was remarried for a number of years. He lives with his wife and a 12-year-old stepdaughter. Bob had a 15-year-old daughter and a 17-year-old son. And Bob, according to Bob, never passed judgment, according to Bob, his wife had poisoned their minds. They had mandated visitation. They came to the house on the weekends, and all they did was play with their games and gripe about things and ask for money as they were on their way out the door. So what we did with Bob, this is a larger picture, but I'm going to hit on the highlights. Bob put $1.5 million into a foundation. He named himself, his wife, and all three of those kids as board members of the foundation. And he stipulated that all heirs must participate in foundation business. We required quarterly multi-day meetings and they would have those at fun spots, like they did, but they had money, so they put it. They they did one on a cruise, for example. They're captive, there's fun stuff to do together, but in between they would have the meetings on foundation business. We developed a board succession plan for future family participation. For example, any future spouse would have voting rights after 1 year of marriage, and future children would begin participation at 10. Things like that, that said how that board would be built. They developed a family wealth vision statement where they outlined what was important to the family, and they did this together in a facilitated way. What was important to them, what were the values they identified, clear values, and they judged everything that would be funded by those values, in addition to doing a lot of research on that was required on how well that organization was spending their money. After only two meetings, Bob told the kids, you don't even really have to come for the mandated visitation if you don't want to. You have to be there, so do what you want. The kids, though, because they were having these kind of values discussions, despite themselves, they saw that Bob was not really that bad of a guy, that Bob really shared a lot of values that they had. They saw that the stepmom and the 12-year-old stepsister were real people that also shared a lot of values. And the kid, and Bob saw that his kids really weren't as bad as he was thinking they were based on their behavior. So now, and very shortly after that, the kids started coming to visit, like, on purpose. So giving as a family actually fixed that family, those problems in that family, in a way that few other things could do, because they were having values discussions in a context that wasn't preachy. So you don't have to have, like, lots of problems in your family. So my next example are Bill and Linda, who were maybe the most perfect family I have ever met in my life. Both had been hard workers. Bill had had a home medical care company. They had lived comfortably, but they weren't rich their whole life. They had raised four girls who had all, Bob would tell you the most important thing he ever did in his life was raise four girls who could take care of themselves. All of the girls were married well. They all had really nice kids. They all lived in different cities. Bob thought that handing, when he sold the business and he got all that money, he said, handing, it is not good to hand anybody that much money. He just didn't think it was going to be good for those kids if he handed them the money. And Linda was really happy that her girls were still very close. Even though they lived in separate cities, they still visited. They still had sister trips where they would meet. And so they were still close. But Linda was afraid that the kids, the cousins, were going to lose that connection. So, and they had made gifts to the church. They had made gifts to, you know, places here and there. But they really hadn't been big philanthropy people. When they got the money, they decided, we need to do that. So what we did with Bill and Linda, and I didn't even know this was possible, but I just said, wouldn't it be nice if we could, to the estate planner, and he said, well, we could, and I said, well, then we should. But what we did was they put $2 million into a foundation. And I said, well, if their priority is to keep the family together, couldn't they put it, like, couldn't they have, like, a family unity fund where they could only use the money for things that the family was doing together? And he said, yes, it's structured as all fancy stuff, trust and whatever. And I said, well, whatever you want to do. But we just want a pool of money so that if there is a starving artist child in the group, they can still come. So that if there's something going on, Grandma and Grandpa will always be able to foot the bill so that everyone can participate, which filled Linda's desire to have the kids stay close, have that the cousins stay close. They also developed a mission statement and basic funding guidelines. All of the daughters who are now adults, you know, older adults now, they all contribute to the fund as well. And they do this, I think they do theirs twice a year. They use family philanthropy as their excuse to get together on a regular basis. And because of the Family Unity Fund, Grandma and Grandpa will be making sure that happens long after they're gone. So that's great. Good for them. They have a lot of money and they can do it. But not everyone has a couple of $1 million lying around that they can do that with. It's okay. Now we're going to talk about the Blevins family fortune. Now, this is one that had been done before. I had nothing to do with this, but I think it's the same thing. It's the exact same thing that we were talking about. Mom and Dad Blevins were hardworking, regular folks. They were middle class all the way. Their foundation was really more of a coffee can. And from the time the kids were young, they budgeted for what they knew they could afford to give and kept it in that coffee can. And they would have family meetings. And they had exactly the same kinds of conversations with their children when they were young. And as they grew up, as they went away and the fund grew, they continued to have them with their grown children. The children became very excited about what they were giving and the causes that they were choosing. And in fact, they would all bring ideas to the table, and there were rules about how much information they had to bring. So two of the brothers became very competitive about who could find the best one and get the family to rally behind that one. And they lived across the country from one another, but they kept the discussion going all year long. So some years the foundation was really lean, and other years, it grew. And over time, it grew to the point where they had like $10,000 a year, and they traded in the coffee can for a donor-advised fund with tax benefits. But every gift they made was carefully discussed and agreed upon by every family member. And as the family has grown, those two brothers are in their 60s now. And so their grandchildren are attending these meetings as well. So as the family grew, the discussions grew. As the children grow up, they start contributing. These two brothers, now well into their 60s, conspire all year long. And they're too funny to listen, because I heard the one guy speaking. Everyone looks forward to the annual business meeting and uses it as a reason to keep in touch throughout the year. The regular old Blevins family has pumped tens of thousands of dollars into philanthropy, and they've kept important values alive and well. So all of these families are stronger now because they used philanthropy as a family unity tool. And they also maximized the impact of their giving because they incorporated smart giving and smart selection of recipients into the plan. Now, I know that very few of us can do the same thing that these very affluent families have done, but whether you have $500 to give each year or $5 million, you can have those same kinds of conversations with the people in whatever group you're doing it with, whether it's your family or whether it's a group within the church. As a UU who's raised a number of UU kids, I know that we don't get the benefit of a prescribed moral and ethical code and have it reinforced when we take the kids to church, like more traditional religions do. We value thought and a much more cerebral way of determining right from wrong. That's great once you're an adult, but sometimes it's a little tricky to convey those values to children without being overtly preachy. That's why philanthropy is tailor-made for each of us as you use, as a teaching tool, if we use it correctly, even if we're not super rich. There's a mountain of research out there that backs me up, but in a nutshell, I'll sum it up here. And this comes from the highest minds and a lot of research that's been done on the topic. Because philanthropy, by its very nature, concerns those outside of the self, participating in charitable decisions as a family or a community offers the unique opportunity for frank discussion of larger values issues. It offers a forum for discussion as people. Not parents or children or grandparents or spouses, but as separate individuals with values that encompass who we are and how we see the world. These intergenerational discussions allow parents and grandparents and older community members a unique opportunity to pass down values lessons in a deliberate manner without sounding bossy or nagging. It also allows those of us who are older to hear the wisdom of youth and lets us really see how well we're doing at transferring those values to the next generation. When children, both young and grown, participate actively in family and cooperative decisions on philanthropy, they feel a much stronger ownership of the values choices that led them to those decisions. They're not mom and dad's values anymore. They're our values. And the causes they support become our impact on the world. Mere lectures about what our family is about or what our church is about will never accomplish as much as putting your money where your mouth is as a family or as a church. When we engage in family and cooperative giving, we grow family unity and stronger, more committed community, exactly what makes our congregation stronger. Another one of the selfish benefits of philanthropy that cannot be overstated is that it feels good, and everybody deserves to feel good. That goes for us, for our children, for everybody. I used to develop and run programs for homeless children in Memphis for years. And early on, I decided, because people were forever giving the kids things, and I knew how my kids liked to give that. So I decided they're homeless kids, but everybody has something they could give. And so I didn't know how it was going to go. I just knew that we should try it. So at Christmas time, we told the kids about a very low-income senior, a home for seniors. Very low-income, most of the people there never had visitors, never had anybody. And so I explained to the kids that people gave things to us because they had things and they knew that we needed them, like backpacks and that kind of thing. And I said, you have something that someone else doesn't have. And I told them about these old people at this nursing home, and we decided we would do cards and make these little baskets of things to bring to them. So the kids drew all their cards. And I explained to them, like I did to these kids, that they were philanthropists, that that's what that was about. And those kids loved it. I had kids who would do it like in between times and tell me I needed to take it over there. I had kids who wanted their own copy of the thank you letter that the director of the nursing home had written to us. Then they insisted we needed to do it again at Valentine's Day, and we needed to do it at Easter, and so it became a thing that we did. And we did it with another group that I was affiliated with, and it was for a veteran's shelter, and it was the same reaction. Getting a sense, just exactly like the research on super wealthy demonstrate, my homeless kid proved that getting a sense of accomplishment from giving actually results in people giving more and giving more often. So, and then giving as a community benefits us because it gives us clout. Individually, our gifts are mere drops in a huge, unmanageable bucket. But together we can make an undeniable splash when we deliberately focus our giving on our values and the values that we share. As you use in Memphis, we tended to focus our giving on LGBT issues and things that in the Bible Belt we knew that we would pretty much be the only ones doing. And although I worked with homeless children and pregnant and parenting youth, I seldom would recruit my own church to do things for them because I knew that as a church we were needed elsewhere where there wasn't as much support. So where do you start? Make philanthropy important family or group business. You use philanthropy as your reason for convening on a regular basis. Don't just wait for weddings or funerals like everybody else. Then plan for family fun activities surrounding that so people look forward to it and you have those meaningful discussions in between that together time. As a group, the first step, probably, is to inventory your values. There's, I have on my website at mylifemessages.com, there is a, in the giving section, there is a conversation starter. This is a piece of paper you can download, and it sort of walks you through the process. It lists values and kind of walks you through a conversation to have with your group. So as a group, inventory the gifts you bring to the table. Include everything, money, possessions, connections, resources, talents, time, everything that you have that can be used really for anything. Spend time, again, clarifying your values. Talk about why each one is important, why which ones are, why not only which ones are important, but why those are more important, which ones might not be broadly supported by others, about how those values are reflected in the way you live every day, and why it's important that each of those values exists. Not just about why you think it, but engage a conversation. And you'll be really surprised what kids can bring to the table. When considering an organization or cause to support, have the group identify precisely which one of those values is addressed so you know why you're giving. Don't just wait to be asked. Be proactive and know why you're giving to whom you're giving. And don't just give money. Discuss as a group all the ways you can invest to help the cause. Use that inventory of gifts to multiply the impact you can make. For example, we had a donor to the homeless, to my homeless children's program. She'd been given for years. And I found out after years she'd given me $100 here and there, that her husband worked at a company where they made backpacks. And so it just, she could have made her gift go way further if she had just given the backpacks directly. Not all of us can do that, but a lot of times you'd be surprised what resources you have in your back pocket that somebody can use. Then always evaluate how you did afterwards with the group. How did it make them feel? Do they think the organization did a good job? Then discuss how, knowing what you know now, you might make even more of an impact in that area, whether it be changing the organization or just doing something a little more based on your knowledge. So that's kind of the Reader's Digest version here, but I don't have all the answers, but I do know that it is to everyone's advantage, especially, I believe, to a congregation's advantage, if we get something from our giving.
Okay, we've got time for a few questions. So if you have a question or a comment, we'll start over here.
Thank you very much for adding a lot of interesting ideas to the mix. I think individual and as a congregation, there is a reservoir of desire to give and to feel like we're being effective with it. I was tasked with counting the money from our plate of offering 2 weeks ago, which was the time when we gave our offering to Planned Parenthood. And it was the largest contribution that I can ever remember. It created a stack of $1 bills that would have choked a horse. $339. But, you know, the idea of aligning our giving and making a real program out of it, I think is something that is very, very attractive.
Yeah, for things, especially those kinds of things. And since moving to Portland, this is sort of a little liberal bubble. And so, I don't want to say, but it's a little bit, would you, I was the community services director of Planned Parenthood in Memphis, Tennessee, in the late 80s and early 90s. And what's going on across the country with those issues is, I think it's hard to really get your head around it when we live here. And things like Planned Parenthood, things like that giving that obviously gets this response from us as a group, that is the way to make the splash. I mean, that is how you make the splash. It's in force of numbers. And also giving, you know, a lot of our kids, maybe we didn't sit down and talk about why we give to Planned Parenthood. They know we like Planned Parenthood. They might know we give money to Planned Parenthood. But just something as simple as discussing why. Now, we are the community services director of Planned Parenthood and the president of Memphis Now in Memphis, Tennessee. You kind of have to tell your kids what it's about, because the kids are being told that, you know, your mom is going to hell and, you know, things like that on a daily basis. So focusing that giving and doing it in a way that we're priming the pump for future generations as they come up, and so that those future generations have ownership of it, they understand it, and so they will continue that support, I think is increasingly important.
My name is David. We have a family foundation, and we have a lot of the elements that you talked about. We have the one where we have some values that drive the foundation,
mm-hmm.
That my dad kind of came up with, you know. And then he's kind of asked some of his kids to, can I have, you know, hey, you should find something, some reason to donate money, you know. And so we've kind of participated on that level.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd be really interested to listen to your talk one more time, you know, on CD, and have my dad listen to it and just try to figure out how to, because we have the family gatherings and we have the mom and family that likes to get everybody to talk about things. You just haven't had, you know, that conversation about, like, you make it sound like the kids kind of join the conversation about, and we're not quite there yet. And when you said 10 years or older, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm like, it feels like we have to be over 30 to join the conversation right now. So I would love for my dad, I know you're listening right now. I would love for my dad to kind of hear this and for us to grow in that conversation and get to that third step and not just dwell on the first two.
Mm-hmm. Go to inspiredlegacies.com, and actually there's a book called Inspired Philanthropy written by Tracy Gehry about Tracy comes from like mega, 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 mega money. And she inherited it as a very young woman and went looking for ways. She told all her financial advisors and everything that I don't need this money. I want to give it away. And then she realized that there was nobody there to help her do that in a way that was smart, that would really target the issues. So she went about developing resources to help other people that wanted to do the same. But she has a book called Inspired Philanthropy, and there are worksheets on the website. You don't actually have to buy the book. You can just download the whole book almost free. But the Inspired Philanthropy is very sort of it kind of walks you through the process of matching values to giving.
Thank you, Tracy.